the mound. Urban's got it. Nobody's covered second base.
I saw this right. Did Jeff Francoeur get this and throw it straight in the ground? He had a little stumble here. And that's the shortest throw you'll ever see. He just missed the cutoff, man.
Look at the phone. It's off the hook. Look at that slow. He's going to use the towel. This is a bad night.
Pitcher. He's warming it up.
When the uniforms turned powder blue, the edge dropped off, and the sweet smell of success turned sour.
The Fanatic, his hot dog shooting gun, that sets 98 miles an hour of compressed meat headed right at your noggin.
Welcome to the Dirty Inning.
Hello!
The podcast where we talk about the dumbest, funniest, and most obscure innings in Philadelphia Phillies history. And honestly, Trev... I'm Justin Clue. With me is Trevor Strunk.
It's me.
Honestly, Trev, the dirty innings have been a little few and far between lately for the modern Phillies.
It's true. Although, I guess, like, you know, last night there were some. I mean...
Well, most recently. Yeah, you're right. It's not like...
But no, other than that, though, it's been pretty great.
What I'm saying is the vibes coming off this team weren't the vibes of a team people wanted to hear about losing in humiliating and stupid fashion, which immediately puts a hole in our listener base.
No, everyone's happy about it. Everyone wants to hear about this.
Everyone wants to hear this stupid bullshit. They're all lining up, Justin. They have their hands cupped.
Oh,
ready.
Hey, tell me how bad my team is. Are you also a fan? Oh, cool.
And we haven't gotten any of those, why not do a show about the best Phillies innings of all time in a long time. So I think people are getting the point.
I like when people send us that because we just can say, that would be a boring show.
That's stupid. You're stupid.
What a terrible idea for a show. I feel bad saying it, but it is a horrible idea for a show. If that's what you're thinking about, I mean, you could just like go ahead and look up fun innings or something like that. There's a million podcasts that do that. I can't even begin to understand why people would want that.
Just saying, when the team is doing well, it becomes, you know, I don't want to trash the Phillies. You know, I'm less in the mood to trash a team that's doing well because it's what I've wanted. It's what I've wanted for so long, and to see them win 9 games in a row was very thrilling, even with them getting absolutely pasted by the Diamondbacks in the 10th game.
It's just what happens. You get pasted sometimes.
It's just what happens. It just happens. And you know, as we all watched the Phillies win 9 games in a row, Ken Rosenthal also watched the Phillies win 9 games in a row. Did you see his recent?
I've just seen people dunking on him constantly, and I figured he was seething.
Right. I mean, maybe. As we know, Ken Rosenthal is a nationally syndicated wiener with
a
little
bow tie. He does not
have
a big
on.
Sense of humor.
No.
Famous for read the article, Mr. Sugar Penis.
Yeah, that's some legendary. That's some biblical Twitter stuff. I hope the future historians uncover that one.
Oh God, I hope so.
And attempt to decipher it for generations. But yeah, he famously wrote a column, basically saying, "Hey, firing Girardi is not going to solve your problems, Phillies." And then, of course, the Phillies fired Girardi. And were
instantly solved all their problems.
Instantly solved every problem.
I like that one of the problems was Bryson Stott might not be as good as we think he is, and then he just became as good as we thought he is because they fired Joe Girardi.
Seems pretty good. I don't know.
They're
maybe
very cool. I like it a lot.
The manager who didn't want to play him is gone, so now he gets to play. And you know, as you would expect, with the Phillies achieving this level of success with Joe Girardi out the door, Rosenthal, of course, filed a mea culpa saying like, hey, you know, sorry, Phillies fans. Like I had this one wrong. Like my bad. This was clearly the right move because look at the team. It's undeniable. I'm just kidding. He obviously didn't write that.
What did he write?
What he said on a podcast was, I'm a little surprised, obviously, by the way the Phillies turned it around. A couple of things to keep in mind here. One, they caught the Angels in the middle of a 14-game losing streak.
We talked about this in the show. That's not the whole story.
They caught the Brewers in the middle of an 8-game losing streak. And that's not to take anything away from the Phillies.
It isn't.
After he was intending to take things away from the Phillies. You have to beat the teams in front of you. And they did a really good job. Oh, that means so much, Ken. Thank you so much. And yes, there's no question the vibe on this team is different now.
Ken Rosenthal is not allowed to use the word. If I'm not allowed to use the word vibe as an as an elderly millennial, Ken Rosenthal is definitely not allowed.
Are we not supposed to? I can't. I'm tired of using it. I don't want to use it anymore.
Well, yeah, I think we can use it now. Actually, we probably us and Ken can use it because no self-respecting Zoomer wants to.
I mean, if Ken Rosenthal's using it,
yeah, it's over. It's done. It's the vibe is over party.
He's basically saying Girardi is a tense guy that can affect the team this much. I'm not so sure. And in fact, I'm a little taken aback here that the players suddenly ignited after the managerial change. Where were these guys when Girardi was managing the team? I know the schedule is really tough and sure they had injuries like everybody else, but at the same time, was it that suffocating? I'm not giving you the mea culpa just yet. So what he's saying here is basically, I'm not wrong, even though evidence is to the contrary. The Phillies just caught some teams that sucked, and that's why they won. Joe Girardi is still a mastermind. What's happening here is Joe Girardi is buddies with everybody in the media because he's worked in the media, and I'm sure he's about to go back to working in the media. So they all defended him while he was struggling, and the team was struggling. And now that he was fired and the team looks so much better, they have to,
are they even that good?
Because the Ken Rosenthals of the world are waiting for the Phillies to start sucking again. Maybe they will.
So they can say hey, you were wrong. I mean, they might start sucking. I don't think they're going to suck as bad as they were under Girardi because clearly that was a bad situation. It's just weird because it feels like, I mean, you're absolutely right. The whole thing is just protecting your friends because I'm thinking of Rick Renteria. When he was in where was he that he got he got fired of course from the Cubs but when he was on the White Sox were okay, they weren't great, they were fine, and then he got fired and everyone was like, well, they probably just needed a change of pace from Renteria. It's like, you just don't know him, so you're willing to say that, whereas with someone it's like, my friend cannot be failed, you can only fail him.
Girardi says that the Phillies are mean, so I'm gonna go with Joe on this one.
I really where were these guys? They were trying to get Joe Girardi fired or something. A bunch of professional baseball players are like, hey guys, none of us care about this stupid game. Joe fired.
That's the inference there, right?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, so now you're playing hard.
I'm saying but not saying that the Phillies conspired to win these games. But he's also contradicting himself a bit there by saying this team was catching two shitty teams that were shitting everywhere. And also, where were these guys? They're so good now. Well, are they good now, or are they just playing shitty little shitting teams?
They had injuries. I'm not going to list any of them. Very weird.
I wanted to open with the Rosenthal-Girardi saga just because it brought about so many wins for the Phillies, and because, as we've learned many times, there are endless parallels throughout Phillies history to compare our current situation to. And so with that in mind, and also my previous point in mind about, not wanting to necessarily talk about a heinous bed-shitting Phillies loss.
Yeah.
While they've looked so promising, I've picked a game from 1973.
Ooh, we love the 73 Phillies. All right, baby, let's go. 1 year after Carlton's amazing 72.
Which was why I picked this year, because there's a lot going on here that I think in the broad sense is very similar to what the 2022 Phillies are going through. This was a game the Phillies won, of course. It was a takedown of a Mets team that was really feeling themselves. It featured a young player finally getting a chance and hitting a clutch home run, delivering for the Phillies when finally taken off the bench after some initial struggles.
Fantastic.
It starred a pitcher who figured things out and was able to give the Phillies a strong start. And that's why we're going back to 1973 when the Phillies beat the Mets 4-3.
Wow. Incense, peppermint, peppermint. Whoa. Hey, what's going on here in the 70s? Ronald Mozo. Oh, look at all that paisley. Oh, those guys have a strut in their step. It's Richard Nixon is around the corner.
When we do an episode from 1967.
I'm just going to come up with another song. I'm going to...
California now. But as I was saying, this is a game where the Phillies beat the Mets 4-3, but their wives lost to the Mets 13-1.
What?
What does he mean by that? Well, that's called a setup, and will pay off a little later.
All right.
Philadelphia, 1973. Oh, I thought you were going to do
it. I thought you were sick of that. Hold on.
The time machine doesn't work if you don't do it.
Do you remember the 29th of September? Oh, hey, those guys are walking on the street. They got a great strut there.
The 70s, the only time in American history where people would strut when they walked.
That's right. It was an amazing time for strutting.
Our leading strutting era in American history. SEPTA was facing a cash flow problem, which was part of the reason why, I guess, people were strutting everywhere.
Yeah,
because public transit was not functioning at its highest peak.
Those guys are strutting. It's because their feet hurt so much.
700 SEPTA workers were now in danger of being furloughed thanks to the organizational leadership's mismanagement of funds.
That's not great.
Another parallel to modern times. Oh, yeah.
What could you mean?
I accidentally spent all this money on martinis at lunch, and now I have to fire 700 people to cover the cost.
At least I'm not getting fired.
At least I'm all right. And now back for another boozy lunch. This was the year the Sixers would set an NBA single season record by losing 20 games in a row, and an unsigned blurb on the letters to the editor page of the Inquirer announced that everything was fine with the Eagles, so let's take those pompous fans down a peg.
What?
They're always with us, it reads. Now that the Eagles finally have a first-rate, dry-behind-the-ears quarterback in Roman Gabriel.
Oh, the legendary Roman Gabriel.
You know, Roman Gabriel. A question arises. What will the veteran stadium boo-birds boo about this year?
Not Roman Gabriel.
Unfortunately, no doubt they will think of something. That's so much confidence in Roman Gabriel again.
It's an incredible. I mean, it's like an unbelievable amount of confidence in Roman Gabriel. a man I have never heard of.
this was Roman Gabriel's first year in Philadelphia in 1973.
Was he like a heralded prospect, or was did they just like him, learn anything about this person?
I don't know. I had never heard his name before, but he'd been in the NFL for 10 years with the Rams
I guess, yeah,
and
that's fine.
And in 1973 with the Eagles, I didn't look any of this up before.
Oh, no, I mean, why would you? Yeah.
But in 1973 with the Eagles in 14 games, he led the league in completions with 270 and attempts with 460 and yards. Over 3,200 and touchdowns, 23.
Oh, so apparently he was good. Okay. All right,
and he had the lowest interception percentage. Why don't I know this person's name?
All the NFL people are screaming
at
us.
Oh, screaming. Screaming at us.
Stop being condescending.
Guys, I'm not a football historian. I'm just not. So that was new to me. And
That one's on us, everyone.
they mustn't have had much to boo about. But again, I don't remember hearing about the 1973 Philadelphia Eagles.
Well, was that before? So 73 was after the Super Bowl, of course. So let's see.
They went 5-8-1.
Okay, so that's why we don't hear much about them.
They finished third.
Roman Gabriel sucked that year.
Insane. Wow. Yeah. So anyway, you want a more successful sports story? Well, Al Miller led the Philadelphia squad to a championship in the North American Soccer League season in 1973.
Oh. Was that the one season they had?
Now that's a season we all remember, I think. Right.
Well, that's what most of the, you know, there's like Rocky and there's, you know, people in other places are interested in Rudy and stuff, but everyone knows Al.
Right. Al and that
famous.
Good. That 1973 Nassau squad. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it's a famous person the Phil Collins song You Can Call Me Al is about.
Right. Yeah. A lot of people don't know that, you know.
Yeah, it's a shame that that's been kind of lost, but I feel like, you know, if you told someone about Al Miller, they'd be like, that makes sense.
Yeah. Back in the 70s, all we did was strut everywhere and say, "You can call me Al" in Philadelphia instead of hello.
Yeah, we loved watching soccer, too.
Yeah, it was really stupid and confusing, but so were the 70s, frankly.
YMCA.
Yeah, that ought to calm everyone down. He said his success came, Al Miller did, from the fact that the team was fully unified and genuinely loved each other. Of course, he would tragically then go on to coach another North American Soccer League team 4 years later from Dallas, earning him well-deserved resentment and scorn from Philadelphians who once loved him. You know, that's just disgusting. That's despicable. And
how dare they?
This was also the year award-winning photojournalist Dick Swanson took a series of pictures of Philadelphia as part of the EPA's Documerica project, focusing on Center City, the Art Museum, and the city's many, many junkyards and projects. The Phillies played out from under. The Phillies were playing out from under a sub 500 start, and that did apparently very little to shift the city's morale, as these portraits of a mangled city undergoing the industrial rot of the 70s indicate. Lots of broken glass, abandoned cars, sprawling row homes, people sitting on stoops just waiting for something, anything.
Broken glass.
Anything at all.
Everywhere.
I had never seen images of the fountains by the art museum being like on and spewing water. But here they were, with dozens of children splashing and swimming around in them, undoubtedly contracting the infections and conditions that would haunt them later in life.
That's like Ringworm Central. You may as well just like breed them there.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that section of Philadelphia, if you zoom in to the right level on Google Maps, is called Ringworm Central. That's that neighborhood.
Yeah, that's where you get ringworm.
You want to get brunch in Ringworm Central? I heard a new
better
tapas,
get there early.
A new brunch tapas place opened. Yeah. I heard a new Indian fusion place opened in Ringworm Central.
Oh, okay. And you know what? People will say, you know, because like I like to go down there for brunch. But people will also say, oh, you know, you can get just as good ringworms in New York or whatever. Mm. And it's just not true.
Yeah, you know,
I think the brunch is top notch, but you like there's nothing like the ringworms there.
Right.
Yeah. That's why the ringworm pie tastes so good in Philadelphia.
Right. You talk to enough real local chefs, like real bacterial puddle to table chefs are going to tell you that the ringworm is freshest by the Philadelphia Art Museum.
Yeah,
you
just
go,
it's just,
you
it's
go
just
down
a fact.
There. You go down there with an old rusty ladle in your pocket, and you splorp it up into your empty gas canister.
Splorp.
Don't rinse it out. Don't rinse it out. Obviously,
they keep doing. You know what? The all the hipsters come by and they rinse it out, and they say, "Oh, this is so much more. This is so much more like clean. I don't want to get dirty." And they don't even realize that the dirtiness is why the ringworm tastes so good.
This is authentic ringworm. Oh, I'm creating myself. Oh.
God.
We're cultivating innovation here at the art museum.
I mean, just, you know, I hate to say, like, something else. You know, I don't want to recommend something else on our own podcast, but Anthony Bourdain has a great episode on this. You should definitely just, like, check that out.
Yeah. Honestly, what happened to this city? It used to be full of a strutting Al Millers, winning international soccer tournaments, and slurping the ringworm right out of the fountains at the art museum.
It's the woke mob, Justin.
And then the woke mob descended on this city, and now we can't. We're not even free to ladle our own ringworms into our gas canisters. Disgusting. Anyway, that wasn't stopping all Philadelphians from being motivated to complete crucial, life-fulfilling projects. Why take this woman who wrote into the Inquirer from Bridgeton, New Jersey? I need approximately 3,450 popsicle sticks to complete a lamp I am making with them.
Uh-huh.
I don't believe that I will be able to eat that many this year, and I want to finish the lamp. Where can I get just the sticks?
Good God. What a sicko. Did they actually just report her to the police? I feel like that's all you could do at that point. You're like, all right, there's someone coming to your location right now. Please do not move.
I think she would be a sicko if she was planning to eat 3,450 popsicles.
Who makes a lamp out of popsicle sticks?
Crafty people?
No. I don't even... I'm going to look up an image of a popsicle stick lamp. I refuse to believe it's real.
Crafty ladies from New Jersey, they would do it. And you know what? They responded to her letter and they said, yeah, you know, we got this ice cream shop on 5th and Bainbridge. They're going to send you 2 dozen gross of ice creamless sticks to your house. So
all these lamps just look like they were made like Minecraft or something.
It's yeah.
Like something a child would wear on their shirt.
What's the horror movie where there's like a guy made of teeth? Just made of human teeth.
I don't know if
or
that's
maybe
a
child.
Is that a nightmare you had? Is that what you're?
Oh, it's all a nightmare, Trev. All of this is a nightmare.
It's a horror movie teeth guy.
Well, let's move on past the lady making a lamp out of teeth. I mean, a toothpick.
Oh, Channel Zero. Channel Zero has the teeth guy on it.
It had been a year since the Watergate scandal. I know, you're probably waiting for us to get to the Watergate
part. Everyone's like, what's Watergate?
It's 1973. Obviously, Watergate was trickling into the Philadelphia situation. And no, Watergate is not the scandal that erupted from all of the ringworm cases from children playing in the fountains by the Art Museum. No, it was actually had to do with something that happened with the president, Richard Nixon, at the time.
Although Nixon was on the Watergate tapes talking with Kissinger, and Kissinger says something like, it's happening in Philadelphia, sir. And Nixon goes, Philadelphia, they make some great ringworm.
We're going to weaponize this ringworm.
give me a ringworm sub right now.
They call them hoagies, sir.
I don't give a damn.
Gross. So this was actually in between the eruption of Watergate and the resignation of Nixon, which would happen the years before and after this game took place for the 1973 Phillies. Nixon wouldn't resign until the following summer. So until then, everybody would be picking apart the most aggressive case of presidential corruption to ever hit the headlines. In fact, a Philly man was on his way to join the fray. Joseph J. Connolly was sworn in as an assistant attorney for Archibald Cox, tasked with investigating Robert Vesco, international telephone and telegraph and SEC aspects of the case. Go get him, Joseph!
Archibald Cox, we have your shit.
We have your shit. Yeah. Does it make you feel any better knowing that someone from Philadelphia was on the way to contribute contribute to the Watergate scandal, but I mean contribute to, I guess, the case against Nixon
Watergate. Why not? Like that's pretty cool.
Somebody was going to go in there and just throw a vial of ringworm water in his face, or just bring a real Philly attitude to the proceedings.
Ew, yuck.
What was in that water you just threw at me? Oh, you'll see.
I know, there's ringworm.
Meanwhile, at home, the city was splintering in its support or disgust with the president. Some would see a political cartoon portraying Nixon as a subhuman monster and think, yes, good. And others would write into the Inquirer to complain about such a portrayal, saying, no, Mr. Nixon is not a subhuman monster. Now is the time for all good men and women to come to his aid.
Are you reading from an actual letter?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I thought you were just vamping.
Nope. My question for that is, why was it the time for that? I don't think it was the time for that at all. Feels like the opposite should happen. The
president needs our help to commit several illegal things.
The president has broken the law. He needs your help. Why? My help? Why?
Are you a bad enough dude to help the president break the law?
Get out of Watergate. Yeah, I didn't get that one at all. I think that was more of the time and era of like, well, at the end of the day, he's the president, and we have to respect him just because he's the president.
I mean, that was even recently. I heard people say that about Trump.
That still exists, yeah. But I'm just saying. I think it's a thought process that undergoes a lot more scrutiny, at least in the circles I travel in now. There's no childlike sense of honor in the office. I feel like not comprehensively anyway.
Childlike. I really like. Wow, Mr. President, is that really you? Yeah, just it's me.
I think about Abe Simpson telling young Homer the whole system's set up to keep guys like you out, and that's just not. That's how people I feel genuinely looked at it, and now we can honestly say no, it is not. No, it is not set up like that.
Yeah.
So they had just voted in the in more political news. They just voted in the House of Representatives in June 1973 to not lower the legal drinking age in the United States to 18.
Boo!
Doesn't that suck?
Hiss. Yeah.
That was bad news for prom goers across the nation, including Philadelphia. That's right. We're going to talk about prom.
I was going to say, can you imagine being in, like having that like promise of maybe I'll get to drink at prom? If Betsy is like drinking with me, I bet I can get a chaste kiss
There's an article in the Inquirer saying that senior proms are still in style, but I believe the point of the article was was to show that, like, oh, these things have changed about prom since the old days. And you know what this article's going to be about when I say that. What
exactly, like how sexy prom is now.
How it has changed. But at the going rate for a ticket to prom for one couple at Northeast High School in Philadelphia is $25 in 1973. You could head on over to the ballroom at the Sheraton. That price was actually down from $27 the previous year. But yeah. After the prom, the Inquirer writes, well, as to that, one went to high school oneself, after all, which I think is a mushy-mouthed way of elbowing the reader knowingly.
One went to high school oneself. One did not learn how to write in high school, but that's okay.
So a month before the event itself, we talked with members of the prom committee, accompanied by a faculty advisor. Where do people stay when they go to the shore for the weekend? We asked. This was following prom. In motel rooms was the answer. With their dates or separately? With their dates, of course.
Oh, except my.
Some people might get a room for the group, like a bunch of guys or a bunch of girls. I hope you're not going to put anything in the paper about this until after June 14th, said the faculty advisor. No, we said. But this is the sexual revolution, after all, isn't it? Or is it? On closer questioning, those most intimately concerned with presenting the annual senior prom of Northeast High School are not at all sure how much of this is talk and how much of it is real. The feeling deep down is that less than half the seniors who brag about their sexual prowess or promiscuity have ever done anything about it.
Oh, that's probably true.
It is perhaps a great disappointment or a reaffirmation of the strength of the social fabric, but most of the teenagers at the beach will be stoked out with hot dogs and marshmallows. Just possibly even horrors, an occasional can of beer.
Stoked out? Oh, dudes, I'm so stoked out right now.
Is there anywhere you want to read more about sex at prom than the pages of the 1973 Philadelphia Inquirer?
I mean, that's the place. That's where it all happens.
So you can imagine, like, a guy, like a sweaty, like pit-stained, button-down, short-sleeve shirt in a classroom that's like hot because it's summer and like, there's a fan going, and you're all there, and he's got like a notepad open. And he's like, "So you kids boning up? You guys ready to get bones and stuff? Do some touching after prom.
You guys having sex?"
And you're like, "Ah, why did I choose to come in here and answer these questions? This seems like it sucks. I think this sucks. I'm gonna leave." Oh, you can't leave. This is for journalism.
They promise
very
you,
important.
They promise you a free car if you go in. Free boats. Okay.
Well, lastly, Trev, if teens are going to be drinking beer, then what are they going to be doing afterward? That's right, getting the hiccups.
Those cute teens.
Fortunately, a doctor in the Inquirer had a list of remedies for common sufferers of hiccups, such as pressing hard on your eyeballs, pulling out your tongue with a piece of cloth,
no,
or holding your breath for as long as you can.
Okay, that one works.
I mean, that's one that I've actually heard of, but the way he's phrasing it also sounds like holding your breath until you pass out.
I mean, I do hold my breath to get hiccups out. Like, that's how I, you know, if I get hiccups, I hold my breath for a really long time and they go away. But, like, yeah, pressing my eyeballs, it's like,
go ahead, press on your eyeballs. It'll get rid of your hiccups. Are you sure you're addressing the? I said hiccups. What did you hear? Next step, grab a glass bottle, drop it on your foot.
I really like this person. I think they have my best interests at heart.
If the hiccups continue, head on down to the park. First squirrel you see, follow it into the woods.
Buy some drugs. Take the drugs.
I just didn't see, it seemed like we were combining like pioneer era wives tales with genuine medical advice.
It's horrifying. I mean, the way you say it, it's push on your eyes, pull out your tongue, and hold your breath until you die.
Push on your eyes, pull out your tongue,
hold your breath until you die.
Hold your breath till you die. Ah.
That was also that, the top song. In the
We sang that all prom long. Well, let's take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll finally talk a little Phillies baseball, get into what the Phillies were up to in June 1973, and discuss the very game we're here to talk about here on this episode of The Dirty Inning. Well, we're talking about the Phillies in late June 1973, and believe it or not, Trev, not everybody wanted to play for the 1973 Phillies.
Well, that's weird.
That's just strange to me. I think that person's got a weird case of the brain hiccups. The Inquirer
they should pull their tongue all the way out.
The Inquirer tells us the brief tale of catcher Jack Don, a graduate of Temple University who had risen to star status, signed a pro deal with the Phillies, and shown up for training camp in Spartansburg. He spent a long weekend there, looked around, nodded, packed up his stuff, got on a train home, and quit baseball forever.
I see. Okay. All right. Goodbye.
Wow, this seems this is all on the level. I'll be on the train station. Thank you. Reporters tried to reach him at his house, and he only responded with no comment. Dallas Green, the farm director, said Don had just decided that pro baseball wasn't for him, and that he had a, quote, good job opportunity at home and just decided to pack it in. Trev, what's the quickest you've ever given up on what seemed like a pretty good opportunity?
Well, I wouldn't call it a pretty big opportunity, but I quit marching band when I saw the schedule for practices.
I was like, wow, that's too many times.
You're telling me I have to do this how many times?
I have to go home and play Blast Chamber on my PlayStation.
That's exactly correct, Justin.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we all went to our homes and got blasted playing Blast Chamber. I mean, come on, that was normal stuff.
We stoked out on Blast Chamber. Well, how about you, Justin? What was the quickest you gave up a?
So one time, I was with a bunch of friends, and we'd stayed up all night just, you know, fucking around and stuff. And we went to, in the morning, as things started to open, for some reason, one of the places we went to was a bowling alley. Ooh. And I, like, knew this bowling alley. I had bowled there, like, frequently. My dad and I bowled a lot. And, the owner knew who I was. And we walked in here, and I think they must have been setting up for, like, a youth tournament. So when we walked in, they assumed we were in the tournament, and we're like, oh, hey, like, welcome, come on in. You can set up the thing, you can blah, 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 like, go over there, like, your lane assignment probably over there. And we were just like, what the hell is going on? Like, this is so weird. How did you know we were coming? I don't understand this.
That's terrifying.
And I realized, when I realized what was going on, I was like, oh, I guess we could stay. But like at that moment, I was like, no. And it just slowly backed out of the bowling alley. And we left. Went and sat in a park and tried to think about the fracturing of reality.
It's like that that Simpsons joke where Homer says he's going to go do something. It's like they're going to go to a magic show or something like that is the cover. And Marge's like, okay, have fun at the magic show. And he just goes, magic show? What the hell are you talking
what
about?
What in the hell are you talking about? Yeah. But hey, just because some people would rather quit baseball forever and go live wherever than play Major League Baseball with the Phillies doesn't mean they don't have fans. You might think they don't, but you know they do. In fact, the Phillies were so sure that you wanted to watch the Phillies in 1973 that they were willing to give out opportunities to watch them wherever you want. Now and in the future.
Uh-huh.
Here's an ad for the Tell the World and Join the Phillies Team contest. Phillies fans, here's your chance to tell the world you know what you're doing. Enter the Tell the World and Join the Phillies Team contest, co-sponsored by the Philadelphia Phillies and Schmitz, the velvety smooth beer that tells the world you know what you're doing. I don't understand this catchphrase. I don't get it. It's everywhere, and I don't understand.
I like it because it sounds like the catchphrase is... Like, people are like, are you drinking Schmitz? That's the
relax.
Thing that turns you blind.
Relax. I know what I'm doing. Winks at the camera. But he's, like, operating construction machinery.
God.
Relax. Yeah. Make mine a Schmitz. I know what I'm doing. Yeah, seven dead in construction accident.
The beard that asks, do you know what you're doing?
Are you sure you know what you're doing? Schmitz. Anyway, the ad goes on. If you guess the correct number of hits and in the event of ties, runs scored, the official rules of see the official rules for full details. In a contest period as described in the ballot, here's what you can win. You'll join the Phillies on a weekend road trip, have dinner with them, and do almost everything they do except take a turn at bat. You'll get a deluxe box at Vet Stadium with your name on it, with four of the best seats in the house for the 1974 Phillies season. Your name will be announced in the stadium and we'll even put your name up on the scoreboard. And because you know what you're doing, and because you know what you're doing, you'll be interviewed on the air by the Philly sportscaster in the press box.
I do know what I'm doing.
I love the you can have dinner with the Phillies thing, because then in the small print on the side, it says each of the three prize winners will receive a weekend road trip with the Phillies, including airplane flight from Philadelphia on Saturday on a weekend and to a city chosen by the Phillies during the 1973 season, transportation to and from the airport in that chosen city, hotel accommodations, dinner with the Phillies, or a representative of the team.
Oh, no.
An airplane flight to Philadelphia on Sunday. Basically, they will fly you out for one night somewhere else, and you get to eat with what is most likely a guy in a polo shirt with a Phillies logo on it.
Who are you?
Let's be honest.
I'm the equipment manager.
Hi, I used to work for the Phillies.
Used to.
But yeah, you could just have to fill out the number of hits you thought the Phillies would get from July 1st to July 7th, and the number of combined team runs.
And if you think you're getting if you think you're slowly getting into gambling, don't forget, you know what you're doing.
If anyone says, "Hey, you can't just leave the family on a weekend of your choosing and disappear,"
I know what I'm doing.
Have a sip of Schmitz. Give him an old Schmitz wink and tell him I know exactly what I'm doing, Barbara, so I don't want to hear it. The Phillies themselves had a new philosophy under manager Danny Ozark, the new skipper on the scene. That philosophy targeted their biggest problem of the last few seasons. No, not their bats or their arms or their gloves or their legs. It was their brains.
Oh,
their
shirt.
They're delicious noodly brains. Sure, they'd lost 62% of their games the previous year, but that was because they hadn't had a winning attitude. Ozark explained to a team that had finished 37.5 games out of first place that just a few months prior that he would be disappointed if we don't win the National League pennant.
Whoa.
Said this on the record.
Oh, my God.
Ozark's optimism far outweighs his player talent, replied one Associated Press writer, who also drew comparisons between the positive mental attitude Ozark was trying to instill in his team and their fans with brainwashing. Yeah. I went back and I read that quote again, and I was like, you know, there's really no reason not to say that. Even though that like they sucked so bad in 72 and so like there's no reason, because all he's saying, he's not even saying like I'll eat my hat if we don't, he's just saying I will be disappointed if we
don't.
Yeah,
I guess everyone's kind of disappointed. I mean, it's kind of the opposite of what we do these days where it's like a team or it's like, oh, I know they're not competing. It's just someone being like, no, every year we want to win the pennant. That's kind of like our whole deal. Like, of course I'm going to be sad.
The modern version of that is, I think we're going to surprise some people.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone's, yeah. I love when people say that.
I love when people say that.
I think we're maybe going to surprise them. Really? Are you?
What, you're going to like hide in the bushes by my house?
Boogada, boogada, boogada.
I don't want you to do that.
Please don't.
Here I am strutting home from the bar after pounding 10 to 12 Schmitz because I know exactly what I'm doing.
I know what I'm doing.
I got to catch a flight tomorrow to, like, St. Louis or some fucking whatever.
The Phillies wouldn't let me go to New York up the road. I have to fly on, they make me fly coach on a different plane. But
all the while, these teens keep parking by my house because it's prom. I can't get rid of them. I get the garden hose out and, you know, start throwing empty Schmitz cans at them. And, I don't know, they just pick them up and drink whatever's left inside.
Drink the drinks. Hey, so, man, all, this is sex fuel.
It's because they all got ringworms in their brains, I tell you. Thanks, old man. This is sexy. What is like the worst thing you could hear after throwing a can at somebody?
That's probably it. Yeah,
that might be it. Anyway, by June, the Phillies were on the rise.
Okay.
After one of the worst seasons of all time in 1972, they were 27-35 coming into this mid-June contest, winners of 7 of their last 12. If that sounds more average than good, that's because it was. But this franchise had sunk low enough recently enough that any kind of not abysmal failure was reason for success.
It's like how people are saying the Pirates are good now.
Right, right. I like that. I like when people do the old, you know, this team won't win a lot of games, but they're sure going to be fun, which is something you only say when the team is like logging some of its 50 or 60 wins. Every time they're going through like a dropping 12 or 14 stretch, they are not fun to watch. Even
right.
if they're like making a couple of good plays, that is still not, it's still not fun.
People there's like, there's really nothing about baseball. Like there are
that is good.
okay. Don't get ahead of me here. That's where I was going with this. No, there's nothing about baseball that's like fun in that way, right? Like it's a sport that is fun when you are winning, and it's like football can be that way. Like you can have a fun losing football team. Like you'd be like, oh, there's so many fast guys on this team, and they're like fun to watch, and crazy and stuff. Or like a basketball team is that way. Like baseball, it's like, oh yeah, they lose like 75% of their games, and I hope this one guy stays on the team long enough that, you know, I could enjoy him before he's traded. It's just demoralizing.
But it wasn't demoralizing on the pages of the Inquirer, who was referring to their hometown Phillies as the Batmen.
Good work.
I guess
wonderful job.
They've been hitting better of late. This went as far as a pretty prominent image of Adam West as Batman, like superimposed on the front page of the sports section following this game.
Just doing the Batusi. It's good.
Presumably because they had some column inches to fill and had waited until after happy hour to fill them or something. I don't know. They were really, if this was a reference at the time, I did not. I missed it.
I feel like the Adam West Batman was kind of over by that point. That's like a 1969, I guess 73. It would have still been on TV, but it's like the fourth season.
Would have at least been familiar to people.
Yeah,
I guess. But yeah, I just from my perspective, someone outside of whatever longer term reference, if it exists, all I saw was them just being like, well, the Phillies have bats and they use bats and there's a superhero named Batman, but there's more than one Phillies player, so we have to call them the Batmen. And hey, we have this image of Adam West as Batman that we could just cut out and put right here on the sports page, where we're lacking in content since Al Miller went to Dallas, the Sixers keep losing, and Roman Gabriel is not, you know, throwing a football.
His arm fell off
at training camp.
I feel like they could have like really like they could have the Mets dressed up as the Riddler or something, or like, you know, do like Tom Seaver as like the Cesar Romero Joker. Like it would have been good.
Yeah, see, that would have made sense. This was just them being like, we have an empty blank spot.
No. See, Trev, like, that would have made sense. I like that.
Now let's just put Batman in there. You know, that's just good. Let's clock out and go to late night and happy hour.
I wish I was home right now. I wish I wasn't home right now.
So on June 19th, 1973, the Inquirer cast two leads for the tale of the game. One, a sideline veteran hurler named Jim Lonborg, acquired the previous offseason in a mega trade with the Brewers that sent Bill Champion, Don Money, and John Vukovich to Milwaukee. Two of his first three starts in 1973 had come against the Mets, and the Phillies had lost each of them by a single run. They dropped five of the six starts Lonborg had given them, had made. In fact, to the point that he was removed from the rotation and dropped into the unfathomable wasteland of the bullpen.
Oh, bullpen in 1973. I can't even imagine.
Where veteran relievers wait to find out if most of their career is over or all of it. But
what a nightmare.
After seven more relief appearances and a four-inning spot start, Lonborg's pitching coach noticed that he was keeping the ball down, and his concentration was such that he knew of no other area, claimed the Inquirer. I think what they were trying to say is he was keeping the ball down. And
he knew of no other area.
Continuing to keep the ball down.
Well, you know of no other area, my boy.
So wait, he's he's got hit in the head. Like,
is he okay?
Like, he doesn't know about the other parts of the strike zone. Like, that's
he's forgotten how space and time work. He doesn't know that there are other areas in the world.
Danny Ozark was informed of this development, and Lonborg became an option for the Phillies again, should they require the services of an experienced reliever who'd remembered how to pitch again. The Phillies had all but forgotten about him, as coming into June 19th, 1973, he hadn't seen any in-game action for 2 weeks and hadn't made a start in a month.
His wife is just asking if he's still employed. Yeah, I think so.
In the hell are you talking about? I mean, yeah, of course.
Phillies? Oh, yeah, okay, right, yes.
Yeah, but Phillies. Philadelphia Phillies sounds like something someone made up on the spot.
Are you sure you don't mean the soccer team? Like, Al Miller's in Dallas now.
I have never heard of any kind of, Philadelphia Phillies team. Do you mean the North American Soccer League team here in Philadelphia? That's so weird. You're being so weird today.
Anyway, goodbye.
Anyway, I'm off to the baseball stadium. Baseball stadium? What in the hell? Anyway, yeah, he hadn't made a start in a month, but still, Danny Ozark handed him the ball on June 19th and watched him throw 8 innings, allowing only 4 hits and helping the Phillies to a homestand in which they'd win 8 of 11.
Okay.
The other character was a rookie third baseman by the name of Michael Jack Schmidt.
Who's that?
The Phillies' fears of their young cornerstone's inability to hit with runners in scoring position had led to him getting stashed on the bench as well. These were not unfounded fears. Schmidt would finish the 1973 season hitting 196 in 110 plate appearances with runners on second and or third, and only 208 in 191 chances with men on.
Unbelievably unclutch. What a horrible guy.
But then Cesar Tovar pulled a muscle in his rib cage, and wouldn't you know it, the Phillies were forced to put their future Hall of Famer in at third base. Lack of clutchness be damned.
I like imagining that they knew he was a future Hall of Famer. Yeah. It's like, I guess we have to put the future Hall of Famer in.
I'm framing that in the most insulting way possible to the Phillies. That shouldn't be surprising.
Yeah, of course.
They say the ball always finds you on defense, but in Schmidt's case, his bugaboo found him out at the plate as he came up with the bases juiced in the fourth inning of this game. And instead of striking out like he typically did, Schmidt, just trying to loft a fly ball that would get a run in and not do too much, managed to crank one for the Phillies' first Grand Slam in 2 years. The last one being hit by Rick Wise, a pitcher.
In the Rick Wise game.
That's what I was... I forgot to look that up, but I was like, was that the Rick Wise game?
I mean,
like,
how is it possible to have more Rick Wise Grand Slams? Like, that seems unlikely, right?
Yeah, but it's also unlikely to not hit a Grand Slam for like 2 years. That's insane.
Yeah, true.
But this all helped take the weight off 31-year-old Lonborg's shoulders with a healthy blast of run support that had eluded him in those first two Mets games. Also helping him was a frank discussion of expectations prior to the game from his skipper.
on this podcast, everyone.
He'd been informed by Ozark that, yes, he was getting the start tonight against New York, but no, he should not consider this a tryout for any kind of return to the rotation. He was just going out there, throwing for as long as he could, and then they would drag his dead body off the field when they were done with
it. Hey, just have fun, big guy. All right.
It seems cruel, but also necessary. I mean, honestly, it's the kind of directness that I think the situation requires so that everybody's thinking about the task in front of them and not all the ambiguous things it could mean beyond what it is. You know, and Lonborg even said that helped with the inquirer going a step further and saying it gave him new life. He said, when you're so used to having life a certain way and that is your way of life and then you can't do it, you want to lash out at whoever's holding back, but that isn't my way. So he was in a good mental place to make this start.
This Lonborg guy seems like a good dude.
He'd also seen Tom Seaver give an interview on television in which he had stressed the importance of using his bat.
Shall I learn to pitch? That's also how I learned there was a bomb in every hospital in the city.
Who would be able to get there, Lomborg? Seaver.
Seaver, again? My God. They let you out of the vet stadium prison cell? That's the Arkham Asylum.
Yeah, no prison can hold Joker Seaver.
Is the parallel that adds up. That makes sense. All right. So he stressed in the interview, Seaver was stressing the importance of how he used his back leg to maintain balance. And Lomborg, who I guess had been trying to balance on one leg this whole time, worked it into his delivery and saw some solid results.
Lomborg, your delivery's way better now that you're not just like doing that weird one leg thing.
Just jumping up and down on one foot while you're waiting to pitch. I'm telling you, that's not good. He said he was going to send Seaver a thank you note. This is probably why pitchers are discouraged from talking shop in great detail in places where other pitchers can see and hear them. Remember when the Yankees were so pissed at Mariano Rivera because he taught Roy Halladay how to throw a cutter?
Yeah, that's really funny.
Both these teams, the Phillies and Mets, both had a no-hitter through the first three innings on June 19th, 1973, until Mike Schmidt's offense broke through. It had been set up by Willie Montanez working a one-out walk, Greg Luzinski cracking a ground ball single into left, which Montanez read perfectly, seeing that the outfielder was really taking his time getting to it. And the Inquirer characterized this defender's poor approach by saying he went for the ball with all the haste of a man going to pick up his mother-in-law for a week's stay. Oh, mothers-in-law.
Take that, mother-in-law.
When will they leave us alone?
I'm sick of all their nagging.
They come in and they, you know, have all their little comments.
You're not treating my daughter very well. You keep talking about a fanciful game called baseball. Yeah, okay. All right.
I just want to walk down to my corner bar, drink maybe, you know, 14, 16 Schmitz.
I know what I'm doing.
I'm telling you, I know what I'm doing.
I know what I'm doing. Rapidly becoming a very good catchphrase, honestly.
In any case, Luzinski then stole second without a throw for some reason, and Tommy Hutton was walked just so that the Mets could pitch to that pathetic weakling off the Phillies bench, Michael Jack Schmidt.
Oh, no.
Schmidt actually murdered, I'm quoting the paper when I say that, the first pitch he saw. But it wasn't exactly what the baseball gods had in mind, and they sent it foul, letting Schmidt wait two more pitches before playing the hero and crushing that grand slam.
Cool.
Lomborg himself would be an offensive threat on the day as well, leading off the seventh with a single and watching the bases load behind him on two straight bunts from Denny Doyle and Del Unser, with Montanez knocking in two insurance runs with a single. But Lomborg couldn't finish the day, letting the Mets get one across in the eighth, and he was pulled for a pinch hitter, despite being the main reason the Phillies were enjoying a 6-1 victory.
So messed up.
If this game didn't have enough dirty inning for you, don't worry. The only reason I really wanted to talk about it is because of what happened beforehand, when the Mets and Phillies' wives played a laugher against each other. In which the Mets ladies won 13-1.
Why were they forced to do this?
They beat them in the Phillies Stadium in a game that featured multiple arguments with the umpire, despite being only two innings long. In fact, there's a picture in the paper of an ump in the middle of an open mouth scream at Danny Ozark's wife, with the caption reading, "Umpire Joe Garagiola tells Ginny Ozark she's a loser."
Oh, my God. What?
What? What the shit? What is that? Oh, yeah. Like I said, it was just two innings of slow pitch softball, too, with Jim Lomborg's wife, Rosemary, tossing for the Phillies. Her form was excellent, but her pitching was not, Bruce Guyton wrote in the Inquirer. Danny Ozark said she had to work on her fundamentals. And the Mets clobbered her for seven runs in one inning. Jim was able to use this to his advantage, however, saying, "I watched Rosie pitch and she had a real bad first inning. So I came in feeling like I was pitching the second." It's like the old adage says, Trev, behind every successful man is a woman giving up seven runs to the Mets.
Oh, hey.
The Phillies would go on to have a 16-13 record in the month of June, the only month of the 1973 season in which they'd have a winning record. As they got set to play the Cardinals in prime time to start the month of July, though, the mood around baseball in the city of Philadelphia had been elevated from sour to suspicious. Just ask Dick Brinster in the Asbury Park Press. Philly future looks bright. Call them cast-offs, misfits, retreads. Any description will do. But don't call them the same old Phillies. That routine is stale. For the first time in 9 years, there's optimism in Philadelphia over a baseball team. It's a scorned baseball team, one that's been laughed at, chastised, criticized, and above all, booed, booed, booed! But now there are new heroes, guys like Ken Brett, Tom Hutton, Del Unser, Mike Schmidt, Wayne Twitchell, Greg Luzinski, Bill Robinson. They are the new-look Phils, and this time it may be more than public relations built. Oh, wait. It's even better. It says, it may be more than public relations bull.
I guess.
In case you hadn't noticed, the Phillies are flirting with 500, and suddenly National League teams are taking them seriously. Words like pennant and batting title are abound in the Quakers clubhouse. Don't laugh. It could happen. Yes, despite Steve Carlton having a shitty year, Schmidt was hitting, Montanez was hitting, Luzinski, Hutton, and Unser were hitting. Wayne Twitchell and Ken Brett were coming through for them on the mound, and if their ace could get things figured out, this team would have a chance. But already talk of a championship was on the lips of these Phillies that were, again, 500 when that article was written. A voice was whispering in the back of Danny Ozark's mind that he was starting to say out loud, "This team can win it all!" The 1973 Phillies finished 71-91, 20 games under 500, buried in sixth place in the
East. Oh, man.
But for a brief moment, they were the team their manager had projected, a team that would not fully take that form until the manager himself was replaced by Dallas Green 6 years later. Words spoken in the heat of battle are often repeated later in jest, wrote one paper in response to all the happiness about the Phillies at the time. Quite forebodingly. Trev, do you view this as a cautionary tale about the current Phillies or a message of hope showing that even historically we've seen the type of things the Phillies are doing now when done in the past have resulted in winning?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. I still feel like this might be I still feel the optimism. I feel optimistic. I feel like we can still count this as a team that can win.
So this is good. This is what's happening is good. And I feel it is good. I feel like, I mean, as we were recording, Rhys Hoskins got a walk-off hit to give the Phillies the win in game one against the Marlins after a pretty dour performance from the offense all night. They were facing Sandy Alcantara, who is incredible. So that was, you know, that was the challenge.
How is he incredible? It's so weird.
Yeah. It's crazy. They in the month of June, Philly starters have an ERA under 3, 2.98, and you know that's been a part of their success. Marlins starters 2.95, same span.
Jesus,
and they have not won 9 games in a row. So that's yeah. Anyway, yeah, I choose to take this as a message of hope as well, and not for like you know all the negative stuff we talked about, but from the Phillies aspect of the episode, I feel like you can take that and feel hopeful that you know when this team makes changes, it has won and it will win, and who knows what will happen, especially if the Braves keep playing. But hey, as a famous man once said, words spoken in the heat of battle are often repeated later in jest. Wait, no, that's
what?
Bad. We don't want that. No, wait, we can't end the episode. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and download all your favorite podcasts. They're part of the Good Fight podcast family, including Hit and Seize with John Stolmes.
Wait, I know the one you meant. It was he who barks loudest barks last.
Continued success with myself and Liz Rocher. And head on over to the Patreon at patreon.com/hittenseason for extra content. For $5 a month, you get access to Absolutely Hammered with me and Chris Jones, as well as monthly baseball movie reviews, supplemental dirty inning material, and John Stolness's content as he provides it as well. Trev and I will be doing a supplemental dirty inning section on Philly's relationship with Derek Jeter. This is because, did you hear that the documentary about Derek Jeter debuted at Tribeca? It's called The Captain, and it's just one long toe suck after another.
Oh, God. How could any...
I think the director was literally like, I wasn't trying to show how good of a ball player he was. I was trying to show how awesome of a person he is, too. Or like some dumb shit like that. It was like, God, oh, Jesus.
Yeah, no one wants to watch that. No one wants to watch you.
No one wants we're going to talk a little Jeet on the Patreon this month.
Yeah, Jeet. Jeet.
Material. But that'll do it for this episode. We will talk to you next time on The Dirty Inning.